Kentucky Derby 146 will have no spectators in the stands for an already delayed race come the first week of September.
You know, we really hoped that we would be able to have fans in the stands. With Louisville being tabbed a red zone city by the CDC this week, we just felt that we could not responsibly bring in 23,000 fans to the facility for the Derby.
After a four-month delay, the 146th running of the Kentucky Derby is happening this Saturday. Called the most exciting 2 minutes in sports, it brings more attention to thoroughbred horse racing than any other event. And this year, that also means more attention on thoroughbred deaths, considered by many to threaten the viability of the sport itself. Today, more on the reporting behind the new ESPN podcast series Bloodlines, and how the sport of kings landed in crisis. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, September 4th. This is ESPN Daily. Ray Thompson, you are wearing a beard that is not merely streaked with some amount of white, but is just magnificent in its scope.
Well, I appreciate that. We are in the last hours of this beard because my face is itching and it's just too hot. So the very moment you and I are done talking, I am going to have it shaved.
Wright Thompson is a senior writer for ESPN, and he spent the last year reporting a new podcast series titled Bloodlines on the culture of horse racing. Another off-brand thing that you did recently, because no one in this pandemic, right, really gets to go anywhere these days, journalists, reporters. You actually went somewhere to cover a story. And as the rare sports writer who got to go somewhere, where you went was particularly meaningful because Churchill Downs is the site of the Kentucky Derby being run this weekend. What did you see at that legendary horse track?
They let me in and, you know, I only saw two other people in the track. You know, I walked through this unmarked green gate and all of a sudden there I was underneath the concourse where I have been many, many times. And I've only ever been there just in total chaos and I could hear cicadas. And it really freaked me out because I was like, oh, that's what the most famous horse track in the world sounds like when there are no people. It sounds like cicadas. I sat there and watched the sunrise. They were getting the track ready for the Derby horses to practice. And it was just this very odd thing to be at a totally empty Churchill Downs in the week of the Kentucky Derby and it just be empty and silent.
You mentioned, obviously, no one in the grandstands. All the preparations seem different. Everything is upside down. But that's the front side. What was the backside of the track like?
Business as usual, except for the masks. I mean, if you've ever been on the backside of a track, it is in every way that really matters, you know, 100 years ago. It's a farm. It's a horse farm. You know, I love that Neil Young song that he sings with Willie Nelson. Are there any more real cowboys? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. And they're cowboys and cowgirls and they're at horse tracks. It was oddly comforting. I finally decided to see the rhythms of this go on because the horses don't know there's a pandemic and the horses, you know, have their own rhythm of life and have to be cared for. So, you know, there were people mucking out stalls and there were horses going out onto the track with exercise riders. And you could hear, there's a word that describes the noise that hooves make when they hit the ground and it's called rataplan. And I really like that word, but you could hear the thrum, thrum, thrum of the hooves on the dirt. You could hear the horses breathing. It felt hopeful, if that makes sense.
So let's talk about Louisville as a place right now, because the other huge difference, the other huge context necessary to understand what's happening this weekend, right, is that it's not just the lack of masses pouring in for the Derby. It's also the history, the social movement, the protests that are engulfing the city right now, because Louisville is the home of Breonna Taylor, whose death by police shooting has become this touchstone of protests over racial injustice in Kentucky and across the country. So as this 2020 Derby happens, how would you describe the city of Louisville itself?
It's interesting. I mean, when you drive into town, I was going to my hotel, and you drive down Muhammad Ali Boulevard, and I would turn on 7th Street to go to the hotel, and all of the buildings are boarded up. They're boarded up from the protests that have already happened, but they feel like they're boarded up in anticipation of something else that might happen. I mean, there are billboards all over town. I know Oprah Winfrey has paid for some of them, demanding justice for Breonna Taylor and accountability for the police officers who shot her. There's a palpable tension there that everybody feels. It feels like something could jump off at any minute. And the level of frustration at the Louisville Police Department cuts across race and class. You could feel the tension and the anger at that. And so the fact that there's a horse race that no one's going to be at, I mean, it's 146 years and nothing has stopped it from going off yet. So you want to keep that going, but it's incredibly tone deaf to just think it's just a horse race happening in a vacuum, because it's not.
Well, the connectivity between the sport of horse racing and the country at large is kind of the premise of this new podcast series that you worked on called Bloodlines. And it's overall this deep dive into the sport's history and culture as it faces an existential crisis. I don't think that's an exaggeration to say. Horse racing is facing an existential crisis at this moment.
What you really see is a huge divide and two groups of people who disagree, not only don't understand where the other people are coming from, but can't even really see each other. They're just talking past each other.
Another racehorse has died at Santa Anita Park today.
Animal rights advocates shouted at spectators outside Santa Anita Racetrack.
Shame on you!
Horses have been killed here year after year.
It's a shame, but that's the nature of sports. When you're in a professional level, things happen.
PETA sent out a statement saying, if the California Horse Racing Board does not take every possible action to protect the horses, then racing should not be allowed to continue.
I mean, it's very easy to make a pre-rock solid case for the people who would like to get rid of horse racing and the people who think that it should absolutely continue.
The latest deaths at the track mean 25 horses have died at Santa Anita during the last 6 months.
That's more than double the number of horses that died here last season and significantly more than prior years.
Santa Anita has been the epicenter of that crisis. That was your jumping off point for the podcast. What did you want to find out?
I mean, at first it was real simple. I wanted to find out why the horses were dying, because the track did an investigation. Ultimately, the Los Angeles County District Attorney did an investigation, and there were many, many pages and caveats and reports. But essentially, the answer of all of these earnest investigations were, we really don't know. You know, no one could figure out. Horses were dying, and there wasn't any sort of smoking gun. And there were lots of theories about what was going on. And so at first we just went out and said, let's look at all these theories.
So statistically speaking, right, what are the numbers like in terms of horses dying in this industry? And how does that compare historically?
Well, somewhere between 450 and 500 horses die a year. It's, I think, 1.5 to 1.8 per 1,000 starts. Santa Anita was not the deadliest racetrack during this time of all this controversy. More horses were dying at Churchill Downs. And statistically, horse racing at this moment, when people were sort of protesting against its danger, is actually statistically safer for the horses than it has ever been in its entire history.
So you start the podcast with a moment that kind of gets to the heart of this. Tell us what happened at Santa Anita to this superstar horse named Battle of Midway, who was a beloved champion.
Battle of Midway finished third in the Kentucky Derby. He'd won the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile.
Battle of Midway
Midway going to get there. Backlam Midway, and a thriller. Backlam Midway, one in a neck. Sharp Azteca, a very game second.
Battle of Midway battling down the stretch. He didn't look like a loser at any stage of the race. What a finish this was.
He was out training one morning and, as best as they can tell, took a bad step.
And I want to be clear here. Battle of Midway broke a bone in his leg while training, as you say, and then he got euthanized shortly thereafter, all of which sounds terrible.
I mean, horses are really, really fragile, even though they are so powerful and strong. His whole nervous system starts to crash if the horse can't run. And you can't tell the horse to just stay off the leg. It's just a cascading series of related injuries flowing from the initial injury. I mean, it's just catastrophic, and there was nothing they could do to save Battle of Midway. And that changed the metabolism, because all of a sudden everyone took notice, because it was a horse that people had heard of.
You spent a year, right, talking to people all around horse racing. I found it staggering that you found only one person who was willing to describe what it's like when a horse has a breakdown. And breakdown is the industry term, but it describes when a horse that falls does not survive. So who went on the record with you about this, and what did she tell you?
Her name's Kate Papp, and she's a vet at racetracks on the East Coast. And, you know, I asked her what it sounded like. And she said, no, it's not what it sounds like. It's the look in their eye.
The look in their eye, though, on the racetrack is they just literally, truly have no idea what's going on. They're panicked and scared. And I have to imagine they feel themselves dropping under anesthesia, if nothing else, before the overdose of their heart and brain function stopping, that they know something doesn't feel right.
We call it being put down, or a horse being destroyed. What it is that someone is taking a syringe and sticking it in the jugular of the horse and giving the horse an overdose, and the horse is ODing and dying there on the track, usually behind a screen. It's utterly brutal.
They don't just lay down quietly like your dog or cat and crumple. They violently fall over. I've honestly heard their legs break as they fall backwards. I've seen horses run into a fence as they're dropping because their adrenaline's up, especially after a race. So their cardiac output pumping so fast that the adrenaline throws the euthanasia solution to their brain so quickly that a lot of times they'll flip over, roll around, and a relief when they lay still.
So Battle of Midway was bred by a woman named Pavla Nygaard, who you spoke to. What was it like to interview her about this horse?
It was very emotional. She went to Kentucky after Battle of Midway died and went out in the field and told Battle of Midway's mother what had happened. She felt like that was her responsibility. Not that she would understand the words, but racehorses are very intuitive, highly evolved animals. The horse lay down on the ground, and she lay down on the ground, and they just lay there for a while. And she said, I don't know if I was there 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. But she went there in person to tell Battle of Midway's mom what had happened. I was talking at Santa Anita on the backside to a cowboy who started crying when I just asked, what's it like when a horse dies?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he says, you know, don't remind me of that, man. He goes, you want to know what it means? He goes, if you love the horses, you cry.
He's crying right now.
Right now. Yeah. See, he's emotional about it. He goes, don't remind me of that right now. You know what I'm saying? So he had to take a little break because this is an emotional thing. It's family to them. They develop a relationship with the horses.
Sorry, guys.
No, okay, hermano. Muchas gracias.
It's devastating because every time a horse goes down, there are grooms and hot walkers and assistant trainers and owners who are at a barn somewhere waiting for the horse to come back. There is an empty stall with a bucket of hay in it waiting for a horse to eat dinner who isn't coming.
Okay, after the break, let's look at some of the very personal conversations you had, right, with people in the industry, including one of the biggest names in the sport, and what it would mean to actually shut down horse racing.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Right, you got legendary trainer Bob Baffert to speak to you about all of these subjects, and he's won 5 Kentucky Derbies, 2 Triple Crowns.
Justify is the 13th Triple Crown winner!
Bob Baffert, what are your thoughts now? You've done it twice, history twice.
You know what, it's just amazing. I'm so proud to be an American, feel this way. It's very emotional for me.
I'm curious if he was reluctant to speak with you at all about these issues.
As opposed to being reluctant, I think he was eager because he is the only, he's the only person involved in horse racing who would get recognized in the Atlanta airport, you know? I mean, and so he feels like it's his responsibility to answer for them and to speak to them. He's the guy that the politicians want to come hang out with. He's the person who can influence votes, who can influence Sacramento out in California. I think he feels like it's his responsibility to protect not only this sport, but this, you know, by some accounts, $15 billion agribusiness.
You know, when something happens, I'm the one they call. What's going on, Bob? Now, everywhere I go and, you know, like restaurants or whatever, run into people, they go, Bob, what the hell's going on out there?
So you spent time with Bob at Santa Anita. What was that whole experience like?
I mean, it's like being in Memphis with Elvis. I mean, it's, you know, he's got a golf cart with rims, you know, like, you know, he's got a Bentley and the license plate says Pharaoh on it. You know, I mean, like Bob is living the dream. He very much understands the stakes and that, you know, the question being asked in a lot of ways is, does horse racing have a place in a modern world?
It's like this cloud was over us. You know, I think this is the first time that this could all go away.
It doesn't escape my attention that more horses were dying at Churchill Downs than they were at Santa Anita. People were protesting it in California, but not in Kentucky.
So when you were with Bob, you ended up meeting a lot of people who work in these barns where the horses are trained and cared for. What did those conversations with those people reveal to you?
Most of the people who work on the backside of racetracks are from Mexico and Central America. And they are from mostly families that have cowboy backgrounds. And they are practicing the only real craft and skill they have and making money for themselves and sending money back home. I mean, these are people who have spent their entire lives around animals. And in many cases, their knowledge of horses and this life and rhythm that we talked about earlier of taking care of them is their only inheritance. I mean, hell, some of them live in the barns with the horses. They do it because this is their life's work.
There is this idea that the only acceptable number of horse deaths would be zero. What would it take for that number, zero, to actually become a reality?
You can't do it. I mean, I was about to say more horses die in the wild, but that isn't true because there is no such thing really as a undomesticated horse. Even the horses we think of now as wild are simply feral domesticated horses who have escaped. We are talking about man-made horses, and these horses need a lot of food and care, and you know, each horse needs 2 acres to run on. All of that is paid for by the money generated from breeding sales and racing. And so it's interesting because with horse racing as it currently is, 500 horses a year die. If you got rid of horse racing, you know, how many thoroughbreds are in America right now? 300,000? I haven't heard anyone be able to say, well, this is what we should do. So it feels like it's one of those things where there's a very valid point and I can't see my way to a solution.
I'm also struck by the way emotion impacts all the stakeholders here, because culturally, there seems to be this divide between those in the horse racing business and those protesting it.
I mean, it's a different world. The people around horse racing, a lot of them grew up on ranches. A lot of them are very, very comfortable with the idea of the complicated nature of man's relationship to animals, and that cows and pigs and horses aren't pets, that they are livestock. And I think that they don't like to talk about it because they're scared that people who didn't grow up like them won't understand it. And they're right.
So when you look at this fight, there are those that are trying to preserve a clearly rich history of the sport and also this idea, maybe mythic idea, of these thoroughbred horses. But you also have these people who are suggesting that the thoroughbred approach to breeding itself is a problem. And they are championing an entirely different and, according to some, radical method of reform. Right? Can you explain this reform idea to me and also assess the likelihood of it ever happening?
This woman in Paris, Kentucky, named Ellen Parker, who we interview, says that, you know, PETA should not be protesting the racetracks. They should be protesting the breeding farms, because the biggest danger to racehorses is not drugs or the condition of the track or being forced to run when they're injured. That the biggest danger is because weakness has been accidentally bred into the thoroughbred gene pool in this chase for more and more speed. Horses are bred not to win a bunch of races, but to be, you know, financially sexy and valuable at yearling sales. But, you know, Ellen's idea is that you could either save horse racing or you can save the thoroughbred gene pool, but you can't do both. That if you want to make stronger horses, you are going to have to breed non-thoroughbreds into the gene pool to add some strength back, which would destroy the purity of the thoroughbred line. What it really feels like to me at the end of the day, when you look at the history of racing and where racing is and where it wants to go, what you're really talking about is inheritance. Part of the allure of horse racing and the reason that it generation after generation attracts new money in American society, people who have created this fabulous new life for themselves, which is always accompanied by this terrible fear, right, that it might all go away. And so the permanence that they so desperately want to feel and hold in themselves, they find by purchasing it in horses. In what cases does the myth of something make us blind to what's actually going on? And on a much simpler level, the entire sport really is about the blood of the horses themselves.
Wright Thompson, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Pablo. Thank you.
Coming up, we talked to the one person who had the inside scoop on the Brooklyn Nets hiring Steve Nash, and then threw that scoop into the trash.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Here's another story I want you to know. Yesterday, we were all shocked to learn that Hall of Fame guard Steve Nash will become the next head coach of the Brooklyn Nets. But if you're ESPN's Amin Alhassan, you may have learned that last Sunday. When the news broke, Amin tweeted a screenshot of his own text dated August 23rd, which read, quote, "I heard Nets are apparently considering Nash for their head coach opening. I don't think Steve would do it, though," end quote. Now, Amin and Nash are pals from their time together working for the Suns, and Amin's even played in Steve Nash's charity soccer game. So I demanded to talk to Amin about Nash's controversial new gig. Amin, let's get right into this, because your tweet from yesterday blew my mind. Why did you think that Steve Nash would not want to become the head coach of the Brooklyn Nets?
Steve is a guy with options in life. What I mean by that is there are certain guys, whether they're players, former players, or lifetime coaches, basketball is their life. And then you've got guys who have all the ability and the intellect and the emotional intelligence to do the job, but because they have interest in other things in life, they're not beholden to that. Steve is one of those guys. As recently as whenever that text message was, I said, no chance. I put it at zero. I didn't include that part of the text. Scale of 1 to 100, I said zero.
So let's talk about who Steve Nash is entering holy matrimony with now. Because the owner of the Nets, Amin, is ostensibly Joe Tsai. The GM of the Nets is ostensibly Sean Marks. But we both know that influence on paper is one thing, and influence in real life is another. So how involved do you think Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving were in hiring Steve Nash?
At the bare minimum, we're talking they gave the blessing, right? They definitely corroborated with this decision. From the Kevin Durant standpoint, we know obviously Steve worked a lot with him in Golden State. And then finally, Kyrie Irving. He's got a relationship with Kyrie Irving that's, again, very longstanding. He's known Kyrie for a long time. So this wasn't kind of, hey, guys, guess who I brought in as a coach? This is definitely a collaborative decision.
So let's get down to brass tacks here. What advice, Amin, do you have for a soon-to-be head coach for the first time, Steve Nash?
Well, first of all, the last time this happened was when Steve Kerr got the job with the Warriors, and I said, oh, you don't want that job? So I'm a terrible friend, is what I'm getting here. It's just I'm not good at predicting what my friends should do, and they're much better at it, thankfully for them, than I am. No, I would say, obviously, surround yourself with experience. There's a universe of small little intricacies that we don't really think about on a day-to-day basis that head coaches go through. And surrounding yourself with people who have been around and been there helps. The other thing is the old adage of, I treat everyone fairly, I don't treat everyone the same. You've got two very mercurial personalities in Kyrie and Kevin Durant. Steve has to be able to hold them accountable while still giving them the freedoms of genius, right? We give genius and brilliance a latitude that the rest of us schmoes don't get.
So my last question really then is this. Steve Nash is coaching Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. Is his third eye wide open enough?
If Steve Nash's third eye ain't open enough, then there isn't a third eye in the world that is open enough. I mean, like, if anyone speaks the language, it's Steve.
Amin Alhassan, thank you for opening your third eye with me today.
It's always open for you, Pablo.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Troh, Chris Tumanello, and Aaron Vail. Special thanks this week to Russell Donalo, Max Brodsky, and Troy Farkas. I'll talk to you Monday.